Hi, it's Michael Martin. Welcome to the show today. I'm really excited. I've got Linda Bradford Ratschke on the phone with me from Chicago. Welcome to the show, Linda. How are you doing?
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
You're very, very welcome. I've been a big fan for a long time, and I know you're going to be in Pasadena this weekend teaching. Let's get right into it. You started on the floor of what was then known as the Pecost Stock Exchange, and that was in San Francisco. Tell me a little
Pacific
bit about
Pacific Coast Stock Exchange. Yes. Yeah,
Pacific Coast Stock Exchange. Exactly right. How did that experience lead you to what we have today as the LBR Group? Pardon me.
You know, I found that the markets and the environment and execution have always been an evolution, and I'm sure they were evolution through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. You know, when I started as a floor trader, I was a market maker in the equity options, and of course, we didn't have the internet, we didn't have electronic execution. The process of price discovery perhaps was a little bit slower, and pricing models, we didn't have the computer power that we do nowadays. So, you know, these pricing models were still in their infancy. I think that there were, because of that, there were a lot more inefficiencies. You know, on one hand, I think there was a little bit more opportunity just in terms of pricing inefficiencies and arbitrage opportunity than you would find nowadays, since any edge seems to be arbed out immediately, you know. But on the other hand, we did not have near the volatility or the average true range, which allows a trader to take advantage of a directional bias that we do nowadays. So, you know, there's a trade-off, of course. The advantage of being on the trading floor, I was down there for 3 years, and then I was a floor trader on the Philadelphia Stock Exchange. The advantage was that you had the benefit of seeing the order flow, which it's important to understand these concepts of money flows, even though we see them in a different way through volume, you know, upstairs nowadays. So we had the benefit of seeing the true money flows, you know, the institutional clients, what their orders were, as well as being in an arena of a couple hundred traders, and over time you can see who survives and who doesn't. What were the habits of the survivors that allowed them to survive? What was their particular discipline? You know, what was their approach to the markets that allowed them to stay in business? And on the other hand, you know, you would see probably about 20% of the floor traders blow out each year, you know, and so it was a nice, unique environment to learn in that I think that the electronic trader does not have the advantage of today, although they have other advantages in their favor.
Quick follow-up. I've been to almost all the floors of the Outcry exchanges, including all the NYMEX pits, which I just find amazing. You know, it's a whole different business when you're doing it off the ring or you know, being a market maker. You said that, you know, 20% of your colleagues there would blow out. And any particular reason or themes that would come up on why a trader would blow up or blow out? What were the things that they did, in other words, that would lead to that blow up? Was it over leverage? Was it too big a position? Was it emotional constitution?
Well, in the equity options, which is where I was on the trading floor, of course, you're dealing with a very leveraged product. And, you know, these were in the days of takeovers and greenmail and, you know, a zillion different funny things going on. So it was usually people that were short gamma, you know, that would blow out.
Right.
Or taking too big a position, you know, event risk, those types of things, you know, or just people that would just basically be too big, because you did not have to have a whole lot of capital on the floor in those days. You know, initial margins were ridiculously low, so it was very easy to get highly leveraged. So, I mean, there were just like a lot of reasons, you know, people who didn't do their homework, people that got opinionated or stubborn in a trend, you know, you name it.
Yeah, I've seen a lot too. I mean, maybe not as much as you. Now, short gamma, for those listening, is gamma is one of the Greeks that you study with options, and correct me if I'm wrong, Linda, when you talk about being short gamma, you usually talk about being short a call or short a put, and you wake up in the morning and something tragic has happened to your position. Is that about the size of it?
Sure, short straddles and there's a takeover. I mean, that was probably the most common, and that happened to me in 1982 in city service. I mean, that was probably the most common thing that took people out of the market up until, 1986. Of course, 1987, the crash, took a number of players out of the market that were short out of the money puts, obviously exploded in their face. So, usually a dramatic radical move like that where you're short out of the money calls or out of the money puts was what I saw, more often than not.
Yeah, I've seen it a lot too. In fact, I've seen it happen to Victor Niederhofer 3 times in his career, the same types of trades where he's selling options and then they kind of go from being out of the money to going in the money very, very quickly before one can act and kind of meet the margin calls. It's kind of a nasty thing to have happen, but that's the nature of the beast. Now, you're constantly inventing new setups and new types of trades. You've got short skirts, grails, momentum pinballs, turtle soups, you've got oops. Tell us a little bit about how you come up with these and the clever names that seem to be, as entertaining as they are profitable.
No, honestly, I've invented nothing, and everything I do is really basic technical stuff. For example, a grail is nothing more than a retracement in a strong momentum market, and it usually comes more towards the end of a move. So it's a high probability type of play, but with a low expectation. So maybe you're playing for 1 or 2 ATRs at most.
Mm-hmm.
ATRs, average true range function.
Right.
So there's always going to be a trade-off in the markets between the profit potential versus the win-loss ratio. If you're going to do a breakout trade from a chart formation, you might have an expectation of anywhere from 3 to 6 ATRs, obviously a much more substantial type of move, but you might also end up with a win-loss ratio just below 50%. So there's always a trade-off, between your win-loss ratio versus the perceived expectation. Now, the names for some of these things, like, for example, oops, I had nothing to do with that. That was Larry Williams originally 15, 20 years ago. What we do, if you're defining something by a little kitschy name, such
right.
as an ante or a pinball sale or something like that, you're effectively doing two things. A, you are just simply defining a structure, a technical structure, and the way that I perceive structure is just simply based on swing highs and swing lows, the length of the swing up and down, and the duration of that swing. So it's really pretty basic, classic swing trading there, doing pullbacks in the direction of the trend or what defines a trend reversal, yada, yada, yada. So you are, A, defining some type of structure with a little kitschy name, and it's almost like the power of a symbol, okay? You can have a symbol, and that one symbol can trigger off a whole sequence of vocabulary and descriptive events in the brain, okay? That's how symbols work with the brain. The same thing with a little kitschy name like Grail. If somebody says, oh, there's a Grail buy, it's almost like a symbol that I know that, A, there's been a strong enough trend, to have at least pushed the ADX to a certain level, and second, it's a pullback, offering a buying opportunity in the direction of the trend, and it's probably a little bit late in the duration of the trend because it takes that long for the ADX to rise. So all of a sudden, I can imagine a whole descriptive chart in front of my head just through two words. And that's really the power of a little kitschy name. Oops, you mentioned that. Of course, Larry Williams, I think, was the originally one that coined that little phrase. And, if you say that one little word, oops, it instantly tells me that the market opened above or below the previous day's high or low. And the first thing that I would be looking for would be to see how far the market retraces back into that gap area. And then from there, there's a whole host of things that we would look for if we are tape readers. Is it retracing into the gap with momentum? You know, does it find support or resistance at that previous day's high or low? And it sets up a whole, basically, roadmap for the rest of the day as to how it trades into that first gap area. You know, if it doesn't completely close it and then continues on in the direction of the initial gap, I've got a pretty strong probability that it's going to be a trend move in the direction of that initial gap closing at the extreme of its bar at the end of the day. So one little word can really be a powerful tool, you know.
On your website, you mention, you know, inspiration through sports psychology and some of the books, you know, Positive Mental Attitude. It sounds almost as if you're, when you say oops trade, you're telling a tight end or a wide receiver to go do a down and out, you know, and you have the whole thing. You know you're on offense. You know you're, you know the pattern that the person's going to run. And there's a great analogy in there. I totally follow that ethos. You brought up the lost art of tape reading. How important is that to you in your trading and in your teaching lessons, tape reading?
Well, I think that the shorter the time frame that a trader works on, the more important tape reading is to one degree, because your initial trade location is so much more important. And so you've got tape reading on a very fine tuned technical basis.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the classic definition of tape reading was, I mean, if you could imagine all these old timers sitting around in these bucket shops, you know, looking at the ticker tape above them.
Jesse Livermore, you know, those guys.
There you go. What they were really doing was not looking at every trade that went by. They were looking for aberrations. For example, an unusually large print, you know, a block print, a volume. So that is what really tape reading is about. It's looking for the aberrations, because in the aberrations, that's where the market's really telling you that there is an unusual event or a supply-demand imbalance that can lead to some type of trend, you know, and you know, these aberrations or outliers, if you will, are really where the gold is buried. And you mentioned something earlier referring to Niederhofer, which, you know, there were always two schools of thought there. The ones who would treat the markets almost as an actuarial table, where it's almost like an insurance game and you're the underwriter.
Right.
And so you always have a statistical edge there, in theory. So Niederhofer probably falls more into that school of thought. And the opposing school of thought would be that the markets do not behave with a traditional bell-shaped curve, standard deviation curve, but rather the tails are much fatter than our traditional models. And obviously that's where you have people like Taleb.
Exactly.
His black swan theory that outliers happen at a greater frequency than our models predict. And obviously last year was an exceptional example of that. So, you know, really, I think in a trader's evolution, they go from traditionally looking at this, where's the easy money made, okay, which could be little high probability things that seem to be taken for granted, versus where can I really have that big movement, you know, from that outlier event? How would I be able to recognize that? And even if it only happens, say, 30% of the time, it'll pay for all those other 100 times of grief.
Right.
So if you are going to pursue that line of thinking, I think that you need to be extremely well capitalized and have a very strong sense of game theory. Very strong sense of game theory. And that, for example, is one of the things that Richard Dennis looked for when he was screening his turtle candidates. And only a very small percentage of people are really adapted towards that type of game. It takes a tremendous amount of organizational skills to really capitalize on an opportunity that the market structure might present to you. Let me give you an example. For example, by market structure, let's say you have a big broadening top formation or a very nice rounding base like we had in a number of commodities, you know, from November, December, January, February type of time frame. The discipline is then in when you do get that opportunity in not only capitalizing on it, but those are the times where you have an opening, if you will, just like if you're playing tennis, you know, and your opponent's pulled off court and you finally have that opening to put that ball away, where you must increase the leverage and capitalize and take advantage of that. So true money management skills are not just about managing risk. They are really about capitalizing on these rare opportunities, you know, that we wait for, you know, treading water day after day in the market, but really learning how to tee it up when that door opens. And that, to me, is really what the markets are about, you know. And to get to that road or that point in your evolutionary process, since this is an interview that I hope will be beneficial to, you know, all people pursuing a career or at least, you know, markets as a hobby, it's something that you arrive at through years of experience, you know, and you just can't take a shortcut to that, you know. And it probably took me maybe, I would say 14 years, you know, of trading day after day after day.
Yeah.
You know, to finally appreciate that and reach that point. And it's still something that I always work on today. That's a long-winded answer to your original
question. No, they're all pithy. I'm sitting here with 22 years of experience at the edge of my seat, not to patronize, and I think this is great stuff. When I teach at the CFA Institute, I'm dealing with people who have terminal degrees from Ivy League schools. They've got years experience themselves, and they kind of have their minds made up. And I think you know what I mean in terms of their ethos and how the markets work. And I think they think they have it all figured out. And then I walk in and show them, you know, the turtle trading rules, you know, based on this concept of N. And we talk about accuracy versus mathematical expectation. And all the fates turn ash and white. And their self-esteem goes out the window because heretofore, they tend to have their self-esteem be in and around the concept of being intelligent and accuracy, the educational system. I'm an A student. I get 9 out of 10 questions right. Now you're teaching them a system where 7 out of 10 times they might be wrong, but yet, like you said, 3 times out of 10, the winner might be 5-6 times the size of the loser, which pays for the losers, the slippage, the skid, and then some, and then provides the upside and the gains. What's your experience in teaching highly, you know, intellectual and academically superior students in the game of like mathematical expectation, where you're going to be wrong more than half the time? What's your take on that?
Well, first off, just like I said, some people have an affinity towards game theory, you know, or math more so than others, and not everybody is suited to have the temperament that it takes in this business. That's just a pure fact. I'm sure if somebody had extreme discipline, they can easily find ways to overcome that. I think you misunderstand how much teaching I do. I really don't do a whole lot of teaching, you know? And I mean, my main business is my hedge fund. Maybe twice this year I'll speak. I don't do my annual conferences anymore. I have a little online website thing, with members that trade all day long. But, I mean, they're the teachers, you know, not me. I mean, they are constantly, because I've taught these people that they need to do their own research. Here, there's numerous approaches to the market. You know, we've had lectures on, you know, market profile or scalping or this or that. And then, you know, once you present a person with maybe, you know, here's 10 different ways that you can pursue your goal of extracting profits from the market, you know, the real learning curve is not understanding each individual technique. The real learning curve is trying each one and then finding something that suits your personality or style. So perhaps in your teaching, you know, you might teach people your way of perceiving the market or structure. That may or may not work for many of them. You know, some people I find do extremely well with a visual orientation, you know, charts. You know, you hear people, oh, the charts just speak to me. I have a certain feeling. Charts, yes, they're ready to break out. So right, you know. And then other people actually do quite well without the charts, looking at statistical data and the numbers, and maybe they're able to capitalize that in a way, you know, perhaps something that's more oriented along the lines of a black box, a systematic approach. So that's really what a good part of the markets are about, is, you know, finding that, you know, style that is going to take advantage of your particular talents and that your temperament can tolerate.
Now, what you'll be at the Money Show in Pasadena on the 6th. What you teach, what the content of what you're going to teach there, is that available on your website as part of your services there? Or is this something above and beyond that, like a master class?
A master class. You know, really, I have to say this, you know, there is no such thing as advanced trading. There's really not. You know, the advanced trading is learning to strip away all the stuff that really is not value added. You know, it's not statistically significant, although educators might promote it as being so. You know, so there's no such thing as a master class. Like what I teach, I think a professional that had been in the markets for 30 years would get equally as somebody that had been in the market for 1 year. Sometimes people need to, you know, have the importance of the basics drilled into their head. And truly, you know, the basics are, and all you need to know to trade, really, all you need to know is what is the definition of a trend? You know, how are you quantifying momentum? And where are your support and resistance levels? And I mean, technical analysis comes down to 99% of that. You know, other than that, you're just looking at execution skills, which are something that really can't be taught. Like I can tell people or point them in the right direction, things they need to understand about execution skills, be it working size or when do you work a bid or when do you pay market, you know, or when do you use a buy stop. So a lot of that can come down to execution skills, but that's equally going to be a matter of style, how conservative or aggressive you are as a trader, and B, experience. You know, you have to at some point just step up and pat the pony and start pulling the trigger. And once you pull that trigger 1,000 times, you get the feel for the right timing and so forth and what feels right and when it's not right. And it sort of comes down to that. As far as my website, yeah, for members, I've got like 12 years of classes going back. I think I've got like 180 classes archived there, you know, videos, this, that. So, I mean, if somebody wanted to go on education overkill, they certainly could manage to put away like 6 months of reading material, just, you know, from what we've got archived, you know, on our website. But, you know, truly the learning process just comes from observing the market on a daily basis, as well as, you know, doing your preparation at the end of the day and then seeing what actually unfolds the next day.
It's easy as that, just executing and the consistency of it.
Yeah, and, you know, the difficult part is narrowing it down to finding one or two things that you do well and understanding that you cannot do it all. You must specialize in a certain style, you know, or certain markets, and that's the only way you'll achieve consistency. You know, there's such a wealth of stimulus and markets and indicators and information out there that it's like a fine Swiss watch, you know, and dripping honey into the gears of the fine Swiss watch, you know, it just muddles it all up.
I remember reading in Newmarket Wizards, you said, and I believe it's you, apologize if it's not, you said something about, you know, paper trading to the extent where you'd sit, one would sit down with a notebook and they would mark down intervals of the market like every 5 minutes to get a feel for what that particular market was doing. Do you think that's still a valuable tool as a way to kind of learn the feel for a market?
Absolutely. You know, that's not paper trading. It's trading with real money. But I think nowadays, you know, there's too much of a seductive, you know, mode of sitting in front of the computer and watching it like a television screen, almost a very passive mode. And I think that if a newer trader can pull out a piece of paper and sketch out the swings as they unfold during the day, or write down the swing highs and swing lows every half hour, or write down the tick readings every 5 minutes, that type of exercise actually goes to a different part of the brain. And it's an excellent tool as well for shutting up that little voice, you know, that wants to talk into your head. You know, just like any performance-oriented discipline, you know, if you took a sprint runner or a tennis player or, you know, a top athlete, they're not going to perform if they have this little voice going on and on in their head. You know, it has to be reduced down to some sort of instinct and, you know, habit for their swing and so forth, you know, that they're, quote, in the groove, if you will. So one of those tools for getting, quote, in that groove, you know, is to do exercises with paper and pencil, you know, on your desk, plotting out the market as it unfolds. It's probably the most worthwhile thing that somebody could do.
Wow. That's saying something. Two more questions and we'll call it a day. I appreciate your time for sure. I'm learning a lot. It seems like as soon as oil, for example, crosses $50, the media starts pounding out headlines that, you know, the speculators are driving up oil prices, usually at the expense of the American consumer. When is it going to stop? These greedy people, blah, 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 blah. Now, I was taught when I took my Series 3 that speculators play a role in the market in adding liquidity. They don't even have to be involved in a trade between two hedgers for the process to work. But yet they seem to be the cul-de-sac for a lot of what's, you know, the higher prices or inflation. What's your take on the role of the speculator? Has it changed to be the greedy person who wants to subvert American consumers, or are they just people out there trying to make a basic living?
Well, first of all, I never read anything that the media says. I mean, I don't read any newspapers. I don't look at Bloomberg. I don't listen to the TV. I don't listen to any of that stuff because, I mean, half these people are 23 years old. They don't know what the hell they're writing about, you know?
Yep.
So they're writing in a very reactive mode. It's like you could go to the front page of Bloomberg and be like, oh, copper was down 8 cents, you know, on fears of recession, you know, hanging on longer. And then in the same, you know, paragraph, it'll say, oh, yeah, you know, crude's going up, you know, because demand's coming back from the stimulus package. You know, it's just nonsense. So really, you know, you really want to tune out any media whatsoever. In terms of speculators, I think it's pretty well understood that they play a very integral market role in price discovery. You know, I mean, you couldn't have markets without speculators. You know, bless the speculators. We need them, you know. If the speculators bid up the price of wheat so high, then God bless them. They're giving the farmers a great price to hedge their crop at. You know what I'm saying? So it's like,
yeah.
Speculators are wonderful. We couldn't have markets without them. They're not such huge driving money flows that they're going to control a market. You know, that's nonsense. You can't say that speculators made the price of oil go from $35 to $70, you know?
Yeah.
And if the price gets too high, like it was at 135 or 140, well, then, you know, it's like it's going to correct itself back down to some level. And markets just tend to overshoot in both directions. I mean, speculators is such a nebulous word. I don't even think you can use it because you've got institutional programs, pension funds buying into commodities. Are you going to call that speculation? Well, maybe they're trying to capitalize on their thesis that there's going to be an increase in inflation. You know, God bless them. They got to protect themselves against a devaluation of the dollar, you know. So is that evil? Absolutely not. They're protecting their interests, you know, of their clients. I don't buy any of that speculation stuff at all. It's just media nonsense, jargon.
Yeah.
That's my opinion.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I wrote an article at the Huffington Post recently to kind of say virtually the same thing. A gentleman named Michael Masters went before, I think, Department of Homeland Security and discussed, you know, index commodity investors who were looking for exposure to that asset class, you know, to kick out their investment frontier as being, you know, pushing up the prices of all, you know, such commodities and making things more expensive for Americans, and that they ought to be banned. And I frankly thought that type of
first of all, I mean, I'm really familiar with that process. I had a number of friends that spoke on that panel.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to keep in mind, you can't just single out one person out of 50 people that presented, you know, in front of the federal bodies that be. Numerous people spoke on both sides of the coin. You know, the second thing is that the problem was not with speculators as a class per se. The problem was with allowing leverage to go from 10 to 1 to 21 to 40 to 1. So whether that was taken advantage of by speculators or commercials or funds or who knows, you know, it doesn't matter. The problem was that it was a credit bubble. If that helped fuel speculation, then of course you had greed and excess to the upside, but anything that overshoots its boundaries obviously is not sustainable. So it might have caused a temporary spike in prices, just like we saw in housing. I can't think of any difference between, you know, the spike in crude oil versus the spike in housing prices that was caused by an excess availability of cheap credit, basically.
Right. How important, last question, you know, there's trading rules. You have a situation where a person has a temperament for understanding game theory. In the area of emotional intelligence and like self-awareness, do you think those might be areas where people who, you know, for those people who are, you know, really intelligent and might be having a little bit of difficulty getting their arms around trading in a scenario where you're looking really more for high mathematical expectation than accuracy, that they can take a look at their sense of self-awareness or emotional intelligence to kind of change from having the emotional need to be right very, very frequently to kind of
There's several answers to that question. The first off is that people with an affinity towards game theory and mathematical models have found a way to capitalize on that in a systematic sense, be it, you know, the black box algorithmic trading of peak, you know, five Citadel, you know, Gecko, Renaissance, Medallion Fund, you know, there's billions of dollars extracted from the market, you know, from people that have figured out a way to capitalize on this in a very systematic approach. As far as the emotional content of a trader's makeup, I worked a lot with the people up at MIT, Andrew Lowe, and their studies with a trader's, you know, emotional response versus their proficiency and so forth. And there was a pretty strong correlation between the trader's emotional responsiveness, or rather reactiveness in the markets, versus their experience level. So as a trader got more experienced, basically they are developing a thicker skin, and they are going to become less and less reactive on an emotional basis to the markets. So it's really tricky to try and single out one particular ingredient, you know, in light of that information. I mean, you know, then again, there are people that you just know they're, you know, they've got anger from their father and their upbringing, and they're never going to be able to control that in the markets, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But I think that in general, you know, with experience, it's a, you know, the markets tend to be a matter of Darwinism, and so you can't say which came first, the chicken or the egg. Is a trader that's been around for 30 years around because, you know, they didn't have this extreme emotional temperament to begin with, or, you know, did it get desensitized over time and therefore they're still around, you know?
Yeah. Well, those are all the questions that I have. I really appreciate your time. I've been a big fan of yours, and I appreciate you being available, not just to me, but to the community, to kind of give back. My guest today has been Linda Bradford Rashke from LBR Group at www.lbrgroup.com. She's in Florida. She's going to be in Pasadena teaching this Saturday. And Linda, thank you so much for your time. We'll do it again sometime.
Okay, but I got to give you one more tip. Your Please. Best defense, okay, against being emotional or reactive in the markets, because face it, we all are. You know, if I didn't get a good night's sleep, or, you know, I was getting audited by the IRS, or I had a fight, you know, or a divorce or something like that. Mm. We all can be emotional at times in the market, and your best defense against that is, A, be organized. B, do your nightly homework when the markets are closed, you know, after the markets are closed, and you're most objective that way. And C, have a game plan coming in to the markets, and then you can take advantage of the opportunity, you know, as opposed to putting yourself in a more reactive mode. So that's, you know, my last mention, that is so important for success. The importance of a game plan is that it gives you insurance against getting emotional or reactive in the markets. Bingo.
So have a daily routine. I remember reading, I think it was from Paul Tudor Jones, said trading takes place between 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. at night. And I don't
Ooh,
know
that's
for
sure. That's a good one. I hadn't heard that one. I like that.
Yeah, that's so in terms of being prepared. So in other words, have a daily checklist of things to do. Have an idea of what actions you're going to take the next day, and stick to your daily game plan, so that this way, no matter what happens, you're kind of prepared, even if you have an emotional situation come about.
He is the master in my book, so those are good words.
Yeah, he's one of the kings for sure, and so are you, Linda. Great, you've been around a long time. That's not a statistical aberration. You got to be doing something right, and I admire you. I appreciate your time today. Will you come back? Can
Look
we talk?
Look forward to seeing you in Pasadena.
God willing. All right. Thank you, Linda.
Okay.